Well, we're back at it with this story of ours today. You'll note that we've jumped from Genesis 1 all the way to Genesis 3. So we're really moving along. I mean, there are 1,189 chapters in the Bible. I had to look that up. So if I give a sermon on every other one, we only have 592 sermons left in this series. So we're cruising. No, the truth is we're going to do way, way more jumping ahead than just one chapter now and again. We're going to jump to the highlights. And the goal here, this is ambitious, but the goal here is to get to the birth of Christ by Christmas. So we're really going to move through this first testament. Of course, there's much I'd love to say about Genesis 2, and there's much I want to show you about, well, some things I want to show you with Genesis 3 as well. Is the PowerPoint going over there? But the most important things that we're maybe missing by skipping Genesis 2 are the same things I hope that I told you about Genesis 1. That in a world filled with stories that tell us that the world is all about violence and competition and being the strongest, God's story survives to tell us that it's really about love, harmony, generosity, and peace. And as we move into the next plot development of this story, I continue to truly hope that after today, you'll feel a little more in love with this story, or at the very least, a little more open to falling in love with this story someday. I also want to reemphasize that we're talking about living in God's story, and that our stories are part of this. And so, I want to begin today with the story of my own. And since we're delving into sin today, it's not going to be a story I'm particularly proud of. My senior year of high school was a year of my life that I probably felt the most powerful I ever have. I was our student council president. I was a recognized leader on sports teams, most importantly in my context, the hockey team, and in our music program. Because I was secretly very pleased with having power and influence, one of my favorite things to do was to prove to myself and to others that I had it. And so one day in the all-school choir, my best friend and I really showed how cool we were by secretly making animal noises through the entire rehearsal. I mean, we were 17. We were stealing jokes from my 3-year-old's playbook. But to cut to the chase, our music teacher eventually got so frustrated that he demanded that someone, anyone in the room, tell him who was making the noise. No one did. So he gave a punishment to the entire school. And rather than feel bad, my friend and I just sat there basking in a power we had to anger the teacher and to have the entire school take one for us. Except for one kid, Leo. 12th grade did not seem to be such a good year for Leo. He had transferred to our school recently, and he didn't seem to have had many friends in his previous school. No one was rushing to be his friend in our school either. It was a Mennonite school, and I remember that Christianity seemed pretty new to him. He didn't seem to know the rules. I have a particularly vivid memory of him in front of the entire school, putting his hand up and actually answering at some length the chapel presenter's rhetorical question about sin. We labeled him weird. We made fun of the fact that his letterman jacket from his old school said cheerleader, where ours would have said hockey team. We all lived in dorm together, and just outside of his room, Leo would often be making stained glass panels by himself. Something I think he might have said he learned from his uncle. Thinking back, that actually is super cool. But at the time, none of us recognized that. I guess we were too busy making animal noises in choir class. So when Leo, of all people, stayed after class to name us, I couldn't believe that this kid, of all people, was undermining my power trip. The next part is what really haunts me. It shows me capable of something I really wish I could think I'm not capable of. That lunch hour, I gathered the hockey team together, and I told them that we were all going to find Leo in the hallway, and without saying a word, block his way and drive our shoulders into his chest as he tried to walk by. Maybe that sounds gentler to you than, say, a punch, but I know my own power-drunk thinking far too well. I wanted Leo to feel my power while he was trapped and battered, and I wanted him to feel my power in my ability to restrain. And so that's what happened. Later that afternoon, the gospel spoke to me. My heart hurt, and my chest felt tight. Do you remember the other Sunday when Patty proclaimed that the gospel says to us, "Remember who you are"? It was that. Gripped by that question, I remember realizing that being who I was would require me to do two things. One, apologize to Leo and tell him what had happened to him was not okay. And two, tell Leo that I would make sure that he was safe around my friends and then tell my friends. I did not want to do this at all. Doing these two things was full of the opposite of what I wanted. I was going to have to confess and show weakness to Leo and to friends that I had long been trying to prove my toughness to. But I'm grateful that I nevertheless knew somehow that the alternative was so much worse. I remember feeling that if I didn't, I would live with a deep disconnection from who I was and from God. I remember thinking that I could avoid opening up to Leo, but that this would also mean, on some level, avoiding God. I just couldn't proceed feeling right with what mattered most unless I did what I desperately did not want to do. Say the words, "I'm sorry," and "I'm wrong." So, I remember approaching Leo right after school that day. I remember that he was by himself, as he usually was, and if I remember correctly, he was working on a stained glass panel. I remember apologizing and telling him that I would do what I could to make sure he was safe around my friends. And interestingly, I remember using the exact words, "I want you to know that what I did today isn't who I am." Leo seemed surprised, but he responded with incredible kindness. He responded like one who was forgiving a friend, even though I had never given him any reason to see me as one. And I remember in that brief moment, vividly experiencing grace and kindness, God's grace and kindness. I remember in that moment feeling the kind of connection with Leo that I knew God really wanted us to have. I remember that as a moment of experiencing God. Now, I don't want to paint myself as too heroic in this story, because I was far from perfect after that, including in my attitude towards Leo. So this isn't a story of me fully or always being who I should be. But it's a story of me glimpsing what I could have and should have been. It's a story of what happens when we step out of the shadows and into God's light, even if imperfectly and inconsistently. When I think back to that moment today, I also think of that stained glass window Leo was working on, and I think, on that day, I was stained by acting selfishly, arrogantly, and violently. But thanks to the story I had been raised on, I chose not to hide from God or Leo or my friends for that moment. I knew I should not let that stain define me. I put that stain up to the light of God, a light that made certain that God and Leo and my peers would see my stain and let that light shine through it. And as God's light shone through my stain, I glimpsed something beautiful, a moment of intimacy, vulnerability, and connection with another beloved child of God. So today I want to do two things. First, I want to invite us to walk through Genesis 3, the part of our story where we're shown the inevitability of our sin, as an invitation to bring our sin into God's light. And I want to show that that invitation isn't about feeling worthless or shameful, but rather that bringing our sin into God's light is an act of faith, of hope, and of trust, that God can redeem our sins and transform them into opportunities for intimacy with God and one another. Secondly, I want to invite you to consider as we go and as we end later, what hidden closet or corner of your life God might be encouraging you to let God's redeeming, transforming light shine into. And I want to encourage you to consider finding ways for God's light to shine there. In the story we're telling in this series, God's Story, Genesis 3 is the initial conflict. On one level, that's exactly what you'd expect in any story. After the establishment of the story's setting, the newly created Earth, and the main characters, humans and God, and actually all of creation, it's time for our initial conflict. It's time for something to happen that the rest of the story will be about resolving or fixing. Every story's got this. You literally can't have a story if you don't have an initial conflict to get things going. And given the epic scope of our story, it should come as no surprise that our initial conflict, Adam and Eve eating the fruit that God told them not to eat, is a stand-in for our most epic and universal conflict, the fact that we don't always do what we should, and we often do what we shouldn't. The fact that even though creation was designed to be perfect and balanced and harmonious and peaceful, our selfish and violent actions disrupt that. As much as this initial conflict shouldn't be surprising, though, I think some of us have still come to be pretty uncomfortable with this story. We've experienced it being used as the evidence that whatever we thought we heard in Genesis 1 about being good, very good, in fact, were actually very bad. We've seen theologians distill this story as original sin with a capital O and a capital S. And we've been told that it's the stain on our souls that we must never forget, lest God someday choose not to forgive us because we didn't hate ourselves enough. And sure, I agree that this story is an important reminder that each of us does sin, because I think a world full of genocide, exploitation, and environmental degradation is also in desperate need of being reminded of its capacity for evil. But I also think that this story points to a lot more beauty than we usually notice. It's so much more than a reminder that we're awful and therefore need Jesus. It's a reminder of why we would even turn to Jesus. Let's take a look. As we know, Adam and Eve directly disobey God by eating the fruit that God had expressly commanded them not to eat. And immediately, their eyes are opened and they know that they are naked. So what do they do? What's the consequence of their sin? They hide themselves from one another, and they hide themselves from God. Take note that this is before they've really admitted their sin. In fact, it's their attempt not to have to confront their sin. They hide. But God walks in, and God invites them to a different response. God asks, "Where are you?" And when Adam responds, "I'm hiding because I'm afraid," God opens the door for Adam and Eve to come out of hiding by simply asking, "Well, what have you done?" Now, make no mistake, what follows does feel a little discouraging. God rattles off a litany of huge consequences for this sin. The consequences may even seem terrifying to us. We may be inwardly asking, so if I eat something God didn't want me to eat, the whole rest of my life is going to be awful? Well, remember that in the story, Adam and Eve's sin is the stand-in for all of our sin. And God's response is intended to explain the connection between sin and all the brokenness of the world. So their consequence list, for this reason, is a big list. It's got a broken relationship between people and nature. It's got struggle and conflict. It's got patriarchy. It's big. But back to Adam and Eve, naked and afraid. Mostly naked, actually, at this point. What I think we often miss, and what I think is beautiful, is that in the midst of learning that every broken part of the world is not what God had or has planned, we also see how God relates to us when we mess up and as we go out into a world that's messed up. First, God calls Adam and Eve to stop hiding. Second, sure, there are consequences to be faced, but third, God clothes them. Let's remember why. After eating the apple, their relationship with one another was broken by awareness of their nakedness, by shame. But God gives them what they need to look at one another again. Those fig leaves were only going to take care of the problem for so long, right? And then fourth, God goes with them into the muck of life after mistakes. God's right there in the next story, in the thick of their family conflict. In fact, when their son, after murdering his own brother, howls to God, "You're going to abandon me because of this," God exclaims, "Not so," with a full-on exclamation point in my Bible. In other words, after the original sin, God calls the original sinners out of hiding. And in doing so, God calls them back into God's light, a light in which their relationships may be hard and never again perfect, but will ultimately have potential to be good again. And in that light, God continues to be in relationship with them, to walk with them into life after bad decisions. You know, I've often felt like the angels that are then set at the gates of Eden are God just sort of rubbing in the consequences. But this week I read that Gerhard von Rott, he's a theologian, he sees it differently. He points out that the text says that God is protecting them from eating from the tree, that would allow them to live forever. He argues that because life after sin is so hard, it would be cruel for everyone to have to live forever in this world. This week, I was struck by a variation on that idea. For Adam and Eve to hide from the acknowledgement and consequences of their sin would require them to hide from God and one another. It would require them to go back into hiding in the garden. Sure, they'd be back in the garden, but they would be without relationship, without vulnerability, and the beautiful, miraculous, healing, transformative connections that can happen when we step out of the bushes and into God's light. Once we've accepted that we can't be perfect, we can either hide under a sham fake of perfection, or we can just allow ourselves to truly be known. We're no different than Adam and Eve. Sure, yes, in that we sin, but just as importantly, in that after we sin, the really dirty, compounding problem is that we are inclined to hide, to spend less time praying to, thinking about, and listening for God because we're ashamed of what we've done, and to be less open, honest, and caring for others around us because we're ashamed for them to know too. But the good news, the God's story news, the gospel news is that God calls out to us, "What have you done?" Not like an accuser, but like a loving parent. What have you done? Answer the question so that you can come back into the light. Say it so we can be friends again. Say it so that you can be friends again with those you've hurt. And here's the really, really beautiful part of it. Admitting our sin may be admitting that we're not good enough for Eden, that we're not perfect, but it is still stepping into God's light. And when we know we've sinned and we choose to name it, we often step farther back into that light than we were before we sinned. Because admitting sin requires us to be in the place where that light shines particularly warm and bright. This is terrifying, yes, but it's also really, really good for us. It often makes us more open, more honest, and more vulnerable than we were when we were just going about feeling fine. And openness, honesty, and vulnerability are the very things that connect us most intimately to others and to God. In other words, though our sin may have stained us, our stains are an invitation to show others that we are stained. And very few things deepen relationships like showing one another our stains. We're out of Eden. There's no going back. But there is still this beautiful opportunity to meet one another in God's light. So, to close today, I want to just leave us with a few minutes of silence to rummage around in our souls for a little while. Think about these questions. Where in your life are you being called to step into, or perhaps just step farther or more decisively into God's light? When God calls out with an inviting, "What have you done?" What's your answer today? Maybe it's something you've been thinking about a lot lately. Maybe it's something way, way back in your oldest storage closet. Maybe it's something small, like just apologizing to a loved one for being mean at breakfast this morning. Whatever it is, where is God inviting you into his transformative, redemptive, relationship-redeeming light? For the next few minutes, let's just spend some time quietly thinking about this together.